Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network in British Studies. I'm Tyler Yank, the host of the channel. Today, we're talking to Dr. Monica Matfeld, professor at the University of Northern British Columbia, about her new book, Becoming Centaur, 18th Century Masculinity and English Horsemanship, published in 2017 by the Pennsylvania State University Press. Monica, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tyler. It's an absolute pleasure.
Monica, I wonder if you could begin the show by telling us a bit about yourself.
So I began my interest in horses quite young. I was a typical girl growing up, you know, ponies. And like many, that interest didn't ever go away. So I've always been a bit horsey in nature. And once I started at university, the sort of connection between my natural interests and academic work just seemed a logical connection. So there's that. And then my degrees, if you, I guess, would like to hear about those, my undergraduate degree and my master's degree are both in history, so just general history. And my PhD is in English literature. So it's a bit of an interdisciplinary approach to the subject.
So then with your new book, how did you come to write about horses and men?
It was simply something that no one had really taken a good in-depth look at. And it was a question that kept coming up again and again and again when I was looking at the primary sources. So you have a whole genre of publications dedicated to how to interact with a horse, how to ride a horse, how one should look when astride a horse, for example. And these publications stretch right back into the 15th century. But what it actually meant for the people interacting with the horses, so in most cases men, wasn't a question that had really been looked at as of yet. So it kind of drew me in and sparked my curiosity. And yeah, the book is the product.
Wonderful. And it's definitely true that you look at several important male figures in the book who seem to have played significant roles in the evolution of horsemanship. And I know you begin by looking at William Cavendish. So why is he so significant?
William Cavendish, quite a character, bit of a playboy by all accounts. He is one of the most widely studied of early modern horsemen. So, and this is for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is because his approach to horsemanship, his publications on the subject, were widely acknowledged to be some of the best European-wide during his own lifetime. So he was considered, you know, the best of the best. And another reason why, from the scholarly perspective, is that he wrote a lot. So his material is easily accessible. So yeah, he's a bit of a leader of the practice, and yeah, scholars like him.
Yeah, and I noticed that he has written many manuals to this effect, and I found them fascinating to read about. And you combine this with magazine sources, paintings, illustrations. How was it possible to bring all of these sources together to discuss such a so many decades of horsemanship?
When looking at the history of horses and horse-human relationships, you have to go to the most interdisciplinary extreme almost that you can, I argue, because many people took the animals in their lives sort of as standard and not worth writing about in many cases. So information about the subject turns up everywhere. And you can't sort of put together the pieces in any sort of coherent form unless, yeah, you look at how horsemen had themselves depicted in portraits, for example, or later on in the century, what the nation's biting satirists and caricaturists thought about these horsemen, or what type of information these horsemen were recording in their horsemanship manuals for various reasons. for their students to look at and read and learn, and also for, of course, perpetuating their own personal image as masters of the subject.
Yeah, and this idea of the centaur, I have to say, your title is very fascinating. I'm wondering where you, you know, at what point were you deciding that there was this concept of centaurism that you were viewing, you know, however theoretically in the work? How did you draw that out?
I had an inkling it was there right from the get-go. And that is because of my own experiences working with and riding horses. When it's very odd, but scholar Anne Game talks about this a little bit, this moment of absolutely becoming or feeling like you have become one with the animal that you are working with. And it's that she describes it as a centaur moment where both beings are sharing mind and body, if you will. It's fleeting, but it is seemingly, from a human perspective, experienceable. So I suspected when I went to the primary literature that I would see something similar. And while horsemen sometimes describe and discuss this experience of becoming centaur in very different ways throughout the 18th century, as the book illustrates, but the language of becoming a centaur and the word centaur itself returns again and again and again throughout the period. So there's obviously a connection being made between the humans who are riding the horses and the horses themselves that is interpreted in by the horseman as a becoming with this animal in some form.
So interesting. And then you do trace this through these different types of, I want to say, masculinities that you explore. And some are so, the one of the macaroni, I laughed. Could you describe how some of these men on horseback, how this identity shifted?
Okay. Yeah, the book is sort of organized along four very loose case studies. So it starts out looking at William Cavendish and his sort of restoration, you know, pre-Civil War court type of environment, and his insistence on honor and the performance of honor through how well he interacted with his horse. And of course, you know, all of the political overtones of that as well. The book then traces how honor shifts and how horsemanship practice shifts in the early 18th century into something that is much more sort of diverse in form. So the horsemanship turns into something that is a bit more recognizable has a bit more in common with, say, you know, hunting practices in the UK today. So short stirrups, riding fast, that type of thing. And the masculinity, you start seeing discourses of sentiment or politeness and the emphasis upon performing one's masculinity before a mixed audience, usually an audience consisting of women as well. But of course, within that, in that sort of diversity of masculinities, yeah, you have the macaroni figure, stereotyped as effeminate and absolutely incapable by definition of establishing a centaur status. It's used as an insult to horsemen who are perceived to can't ride.
Right. And so you mentioned this, but where do women fit into this? Can a woman be a centaur?
According to 18th century thought, no. which I, when I was reading it, I was going, oh, come on, surely. No, absolutely not. Women could ride. And in the mid to late 18th century, women start to have their own riding academies and riding houses and their own publications dedicated specifically to them. But the writing that they are learning is all about establishing and maintaining patriarchal authority. So within feminine and feminized writing spaces, it's usually the male trainer who, of course, is in charge. And the horse that the woman is on becomes a very odd sort of symbolic stand-in for a patriarchal male figure, like the trainer or like her husband. And the discourse around how to choose a proper horse for a lady starts to turn up things like the horse must be calm and gentle and, of course, never upset his rider or her rider, as mares were also involved with women riders, and that the horse should protect the female rider at all costs. So, yeah, there is absolutely no indication that women were supposed to learn how to become a centaur or learn the riding methods deemed necessary to get there. But of course, women, I think, actually did. And those that tried came under fire for it. Public scandal, public slander, accusations of masculinity or being of an unstable sex, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. So where then does militarism fit into this? I see it sort of drawn out through kind of the first and second part of your book, especially to do with maybe William Cavendish and this question of honor and masculinity that you touched upon.
So to establish a centaur throughout the 18th century, actually, right from the beginning of the book to the end, so beginning of the century to the end, the type of horsemanship practice necessary to establish a centaur was intimately connected with the army, the cavalry. And when it shifts to more common hunting type riding methods, away a little bit from, you know, the army, the centaur discourse also disappears. So throughout the period, to ride a great horse, as the phrase was often used, meant being a part of the military or learning military riding techniques. And of course, then performances of masculinity that go along with it. The ability to be a good general, good leader, to be honorable or chivalrous, depending.
Yeah, and I guess the flip side to that is sort of this, you know, in the second part of your book, you're discussing popular representations of horsemanship. And I mean, you look at sport, you look at hunting, but then you move on to discuss, and I know you do have a little bit of a background in the history of the circus, and you look at the amphitheater and its significance. Could you say a little bit about that?
Astley's Amphitheater, a very odd, fun, amazing, bizarre place. What happens to this military horsemanship is it moves in some degree into the new riding academies that are springing up in London over the mid and late 18th century. And in these riding academies, you generally have gentlemen or those who can pay learning this sort of militarized equestrianism. And one of the individuals who was learning this, it doesn't fit the mold, really. He was a sergeant of the 15th Light Dragoons, and his name was Philip Astley. And he learned this sort of high-class horsemanship in the riding academy of Angelo. The Angelo Academy. And he then takes this very high-class, high sort of militarized type of riding, and he joins with it trick riding. So standing up on the back of a horse, firing a pistol, climbing under the horse's belly while at a full gallop, you know, that type of thing. And he establishes Astley's Amphitheater, one of the first, if not the first circus in the world. And while there, he performs a masculinity that, ironically, a little bit, is overtly patriotic and overtly militarized. So he performs himself as a soldier, a defender of the nation, and a defender of, you know, proper British mores and virtues, you know, that type of thing.
So how are these amphitheater shows perceived? You know, who, what were these hippodramas about, and who was watching them?
So the hippodramas, so to define what a hippodrama was, it starts out with these kind of trick riding, odd little shows, sometimes taking place in the fairgrounds or pub yards, and then of course in the amphitheater. And they evolve over the 18th century into full-on dramatic spectacles on horseback, where some of the parts are written for the riders and some of the parts are written for the horses. So you have horses playing dead or serving tea or themselves firing a pistol, which is a physical trait I'm not entirely sure is possible for a horse, but, you know, according to the amphitheater, it was a standard practice. And many people loved it. It's new. It's a spectacle. You have indoor fireworks, or you have cannon going off, or you have the reenactment of the latest, you know, British battle overseas, and it's, you know, rah, rah, Britannia. But other critics feared that these new spectacles were not only corrupting traditional horsemanship practice, and of course the masculinities associated with them, but were also corrupting the audience. So the audience was no longer being taught valuable virtues on stage. They were just there for spectacle, you know, that kind of thing.
Was there an expectation that one would learn values at the circus?
Philip Astley certainly thought so. Yeah. He honestly did. Him and his son, John Astley. If you read their highly propagandist manuals of horsemanship or Manual of Magic, for example, the whole point is to help the British audience come to understand how to be like them, how to be good at horsemanship, good at, you know, expressing chivalrous values, and willing and wanting to help join the British military effort abroad. This sort of propaganda that the Astleys are pumping out through their amphitheater really picks up steam when we get to, you know, the early days of the French Revolution. So then it's like, come on, people of Britain, you must join, support George, our king, you know, fireworks displays, the whole works.
Were these trends also present in France at the same time, or is this purely an English
They were in France as well. Yeah, the Astleys split their time between England and France, so for example, Philip Astley was given the title of Professor of Equitation by the King of France, and he was given special royal dispensation to perform there at Versailles. And, you know, the Astleys make a huge splash overseas. So half the performance year is in France, half the performance year is in London. And of course, the British audiences don't really like that, because that association with the French does open the Astleys up to accusations of things like effeminacy or not being properly British, for example.
So it's so fascinating to me, the types of people who were watching these spectacles play out. And I did notice, I'm sure that it is evident in the book, and I'm sure you've thought about it at length, but the idea of how class is playing out in these spheres. So those who ride the horses and those who spectate, and do these class lines ever cross, for example?
The issue of class, yeah, it's kind of an undercurrent throughout the entire book. So with William Cavendish and his circle, the horsemanship and the performance of horsemanship before an audience was specifically designed to garner admiration from people of the same class, from people who it would matter if you had a good reputation with, who it would matter if they could bestow honor upon you, for example. Once we start to see horsemanship change in the 18th century, the audiences shift. So you have an almost democratization a little bit of horsemanship. So when you're on the hunt field, you could be hunting with people of the aristocracy, the gentry, or even the middling sort, if they could find themselves a horse. So it's starting to mix the social orders a little bit. And the same thing is happening in the riding houses. They're not only dedicated to people of the upper echelons of society anymore, like they were with Cavendish. People who could pay could go to these academies. Very controversially, of course. And then when we get into the world of the circus, you have these traditionally elite forms of riding and of masculine display being performed by someone who, if the rumors of the time are true, could not read or write. He was not of the upper classes. And while some of his audience members absolutely were, many of them were not. So it's a complete mixing of the groups.
And so this, yeah, it's so interesting. And this idea of gender performance through this, do you think that crossed class lines at all? Were elite men engaging in horsemanship with a different set of eyes than those of the lower classes?
Oh, absolutely. So an audience member, say, in the amphitheater, if the person was generally of elite status or of the military, that person, or even of the middling sorts in some cases, would have, it was assumed, some quite basic understanding of horses, horsemanship, and what horses could achieve, right? Some people even sort of debunked what Philip Astley and his son were doing with their horses as mere trickery that anybody could do. Not a big deal, not a problem. You then have accounts where Philip Astley especially is charged with accusations of devilry because of what he can achieve with his horses. So teaching a horse to fire a pistol, again, I have no idea how, he doesn't go into detail, was thought to be an absolutely unbelievable, understandable act for people who did not have a grounding in horsemanship practice. So that would usually mean the common sort. So yeah, the common sort views him as a devil in disguise, and the upper echelons of society are like, yeah, no problem, I could do this, it's fine.
Yeah. And then you have in the fourth part of your book, the caricature and the satire related to horsemanship, and this figure, Henry Bunbury. Could you say a little bit about how, I mean, this idea of there being bad horsemanship, I think, emerges there?
It does. Bunbury was an author, caricaturist, and some argue one of the first authors of comic strips. And he spends much of his career taking aim at horsemen. He himself was probably somewhat adept. His writings do illustrate a keen knowledge of the nuances of horsemanship practice. And what he does in his publications, they are satirical illustrated books of horsemanship, sort of masquerading as actual books of horsemanship, is he pokes fun at this new order of rider and horseman that keeps coming up through the social ranks. This type of rider, and I do use rider instead of horseman here, for a reason. This rider pretends to know all about horsemanship and pretends or thinks he knows about the inner workings of how to train a horse for, you know, the top levels of riding, for example. And in his two books, one is The Annals of Horsemanship, and the other one is titled An Academy for Grown Horsemen, he uses a pseudonym, and he writes under the name of Geoffrey Gambado Esquire. And dear Geoffrey is hopeless when it comes to equestrian knowledge and of masculine display. He famously dies in a tragic shipwreck on his way to Venice to become master of horse there, which of course is completely ridiculous because Venice is a city on the water, for example. But yeah, so Henry Bunbury is in essence saying that traditional horsemanship in the Cavendish vein, so for the upper classes, for, you know, very high levels of equestrian knowledge, should be maintained at all cost. Anyone else trying to practice it, trying to teach it, or who think that they are masters of it are completely ridiculous, just like Geoffrey Gambado.
Yeah, and I think it's a wonderful way to end the book because some of the illustrations you include are truly hilarious. They're so funny. And I have to ask, you know, on a final note, who is reading these? And did the people reading them think they were funny?
Absolutely. People loved these things. They were very, very well sold, bestsellers. They are reviewed in the newspapers quite quickly after the publication. And the reviewers are just in stitches over what Henry Bunbury is saying about the horsemen of the UK. And the name Gambado quickly becomes a shorthand for describing, you know, the antics of poor horsemen. You know, they're out in Hyde Park practicing their gambados, for example.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so wonderful, wonderful chapter of your book is the one with the satire in it.
Glad you liked it. I had a lot of fun researching that one. And if anyone's interested, read the two manuals of horsemanship by Bunbury. They are very funny.
Yeah. So I think we are just about out of time. I'd like to ask you one of our traditional final questions at New Books Network. So what are you working on next?
Well, next, there are a couple of rather large projects in the works. I am currently working on another monograph that focuses on late 18th and early 19th century hippodrama. So thinking about what happens to this odd circus performance where horses are expected to perform as actors in their own right, as the genre develops into the 19th century and becomes the most popular form of stage production of that period. So that's one project. And the other one, I am doing a joint project with Dr. Kristen Guest, also out of the University of Northern British Columbia. And we are embarking on sort of starting to study the history of equestrian breeding and breed organizations. And it's around the world. So this is a really big project. And it's kind of in its infancy right now. We're questioning what breed is and was, how the idea is developing over time, and how it's associated and connected to ideas of human identity. So that's the two big ones at the moment.
Wonderful. They both sound very fascinating. I'm excited to see more from both of those projects. And I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And we hope to speak to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tyler.